I don't know if you've heard, but climate change is expensive.
When there is a cost, the cost is paid by people.
But the thing is, not addressing climate change is going to be a whole lot more expensive.
These storms are getting more unpredictable.
In this series from Living Planet, we're digging into the real costs of climate change,
how we can reduce those costs,
and just how much there is to save.
Find this Living Planet series on the costs of climate change wherever you get your podcasts.
Migrants in Portugal have been receiving letters warning that if they don't leave, they could face deportation. That's just ahead of elections coming up.
The time that the government choose to do this has to do with the campaign, the attempt to gain more votes.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, what politics have to do with it, and Moscow pulling out all the stops for a parade marking the end of World War II.
The farther away they get from the war, the more pompous the parades become.
We'll hear more about the new Pope and his ties to Peru.
It has been quite a surprise here in Peru. Most of the national media didn't count Cardinal Prevost as a Peruvian.
Plus, motherhood across the globe and how policy helps shape it. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's good to have you with us on this Friday. We begin our program at the Vatican. Today, Pope Leo XIV celebrated his first Mass as pontiff.
My brother cardinals, as we celebrate this morning, I invite you to recognize the marvels that the Lord has done, the blessings that the Lord continues to pour out upon all of us. Through the ministry of Peter, you have called me to carry that cross and to be blessed with that mission.
A cross and a blessing. That's how the new pope describes a shared mission for the Catholic clergy he now leads. Leo's papacy is already historic. He is the first pope ever from the U.S., where he was born Robert Prevost. But the U.S. is not the only country that claims him. The new pontiff is also a citizen of Peru, where he worked for decades. Juan Miguel Espinosa is an associate professor of theology at the Catholic University of Peru in the capital, Lima. I asked him what the reaction was in Peru to the naming of the new pope.
There is a great rejoice here in Peru. I mean, we can claim him like a Peruvian pope, share with the United States, of course. But there is a lot of enthusiasm. There is a lot of joy. There is a lot of memes carrying out and showing that the new pope is authentically a Peruvian. So I will describe it as a great joy for our nation.
A great joy for Peru. The new pope worked there for more than two decades, first as a missionary and then in leadership positions in the Augustinian order and for the larger Catholic Church. Can you tell me what we should know about his work during that time?
Pope Leo XIV, we can describe him like a pastor that comes from the peripheries of the world. Here in Peru, he was initially engaged with the Augustinian mission in Chulucanas, that is located in the north of Peru. It's a rural region. He was engaged with people that were vulnerable populations. So his first engagement with Peru was working with the poor of our country and from the rural areas.
Even when he was in also leadership positions, he maintained that.
Exactly. The poor have been central in his way of conducting the church.
So how well was he known before yesterday to ordinary Catholics across Peru? And what would he have been known for? What was his reputation if he had one?
To be honest, it has been quite a surprise here in Peru. Most of the national media didn't count Cardinal Prevost as a Peruvian bishop. He has had a leadership that has been very discreet and humble. He is not a bishop from one of the most renowned cities in the country. He comes from a city that its population is around 500,000 people. And he has been well known in that region, in Chiclayo. He is remembered as a very pastoral bishop with a lot of concern and proximity to the people in a direct way. and especially concerned about the social and environmental issues in his diocese.
So he did weigh into politics a bit. Comment on the leadership in Peru when he was there.
One of the most controversial issues of our recent history is the dictatorship of Alberto Fujimori.
The former president of Peru.
The former president of Peru. He was condemned for violations against human rights, but he received a pardon in 2022. So Cardinal Priebus was a strong advocate that President Fujimori must ask for forgiveness to the victims of his human rights crimes. Fujimori was trying to pretend that anything happened, that he was innocent, without acknowledging, going out of jail without acknowledging the problems in his own government, and especially the violation against human rights.
There are reports of controversy connected to Prevost as a cardinal, having to do with the handling of investigations into sexual abuse in the church. Can you explain that controversy and how he was connected?
There is a kind of report coming from Free Women saying that he didn't manage correctly a complaint against a priest regarding a sexual abuse. But what we are discovering is that this was apparently managed according to the canon law rules in Pope Francis' pontificate. And one important fact about this controversy is that yesterday, Pedro Salinas, that is probably one of the most important leaders in the cause of vindicating the victims of sexual abuse in the church, gave an interview strongly defending Cardinal Priebus as an important advocate on this issue.
Mm.
He said that all these accusations are false and are being fabricated in order to damage his image.
I'll also just add, there was an official inquiry by the Vatican in the past days, and they also absolved the cardinal at the time of any wrongdoing.
Exactly.
It sounds like, as you have said, Peru is claiming Pope Leo as a Peruvian pope. American Catholics are calling him the first pope from the U.S. Are these claims at odds, or do they speak to something crucial about the new pope's identity?
I think it's a transnational pope. He comes from a synthesis of different cultures. So I think he brings the best of the United States Catholicism, but also he brings to the papacy the pastoral sensibility of the Latin American church. And also he brings a lot of experience regarding church governance in Rome and in other spaces regarding his religious order, the Augustinians. So let's say that he is a pope with different backgrounds, with different gifts, and that is, for me, a blessing.
Juan Miguel Espinoza is an associate professor of theology at the Catholic University of Peru in Lima. Yesterday, we brought you coverage of VE Day celebrations in the UK. Like most of Europe, Britain celebrates the end of World War II on the continent on May 8th. Russia celebrates the Soviet victory on May 9th. That is just a time zone thing. The Nazis' surrender went into effect at 11:01 p.m. local time. It was already the next day in Moscow. As the World's Daniel Hoffman reports, that victory in World War II has become a cornerstone of Kremlin propaganda.
In the heart of Moscow, on Red Square, Vladimir Putin delivered a speech where he spoke about the Soviet triumph in World War II. He said that today Russians can be proud as the inheritors of that victory. Truth and justice are on our side, he said.
Вся страна, общество, народ.
The whole country, the society, and the people support the participants of the special military operation, Putin said. That's what he calls Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Putin's speech and the parade itself highlighted Russian military might, with military hardware on display and soldiers goose-stepping through the square.
Hurrah!
Victory Day is one of the most important holidays on the Russian calendar, perhaps only second to New Year's. Ivan Gryak is the director of the Russia program at George Washington University. He says that over the course of the war, about 27 million Soviet citizens died and many more were injured.
So imagine the scope and size of the event. When you have 10% of the population at least slaughtered, this is still a very important event in contemporary memory of Russia, and not only Russia, actually, the post-Soviet space in general, because almost each and every family participated in it in one way or another.
Grech says that in the 20 years after the war, Victory Day for most veterans and their families was a somber day of commemoration. In the mid-60s, the tone of the holiday started to change.
This memory of mourning starting to be replaced with the celebration of the victory itself. Mourning starting being replaced with pride in victory.
Victoria Smolkin is a history professor at Wesleyan University. She says there's a reason why it took some time for that transition from mourning to celebration to happen.
Because this was people's real and very recent experience, it was difficult to mythologize. And it really took a generation for that experience to become a memory that could become a myth.
And part of that myth-making, according to Smolkin, is the Kremlin emphasizing victory and power while ignoring aspects of the war that are more controversial, like the Soviet-Nazi Pact of 1939, the immense losses paired with grief and generational trauma.
The farther away they get from the war, the more pompous the parades become, the more kind of the pomp and circumstance rather than the substance become the point.
Smolkin says these changes were gradual and varied over the years. With the fall of the Soviet Union, some Victory Day celebrations were attended by Western leaders, like in 2005 when George W. Bush was in attendance. This was an attempt to show some sense of unity in a post-Cold War world. But later, Smolkin says the tone of the holiday shifted yet again.
What you start seeing under Putin, and you don't start seeing this right away, is an increasingly a militarization of the holiday, an increasingly aggressive tone that really puts the commemoration and human tragedy in the service of military prowess.
This shift mirrored the fact that Russia's military was becoming more aggressive. Like in the 2008 war with Georgia, Russia's military engagement in the Syrian civil war, and the 2014 invasion of Ukraine. Sam Green is a professor of Russian politics at King's College London and is also with the Center for European Policy Analysis. He says those narratives leaked into the way some people in Russia began talking about war.
It used to be that people would talk about life in Russia and use this phrase, you know, so long as there's no war, right? In Russian, lish by ne bylo vojny. And you would hear that a lot. And at some point in the last 15 years or so, that became replaced much more by this phrase, mozhem povtorit, we can do it again.
Green says Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine brought this militaristic sentiment to a new level. Soon, any dissent against the war or against the Victory Day narrative became intolerable.
Russia is about greatness, and the symbol of that greatness is the victory over fascism. And thus, if you complicate that picture of greatness, or even challenge what Russia is today, you are with the fascists. In fact, you are probably a fascist yourself.
For a decade, the Kremlin has been spreading propaganda claiming that Ukraine is a Nazi state and that Russia is fighting against it.
So that World War II becomes the justification for the war in Ukraine. So, of course, that shows up in the symbolism around Victory Day itself. But it is not just confined to Victory Day. It's something that is ever present every day.
Posters, recruitment ads, and war imagery are part of everyday life in Russia. However, Victoria Smolkin says the Kremlin is ignoring the casualties in Ukraine.
Trying to not allow grief into the story. There's somehow supposed to be this disconnect between the cost of war and war.
Since 2022, Ukraine has marked Victory in Europe Day on May 8th, breaking away from the Russian tradition. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called Russia's celebration a parade of fear, of cynicism, and lies. And he said the world needs to unite against the threat that Russia poses today. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
And we have an update now to a story we brought you last week about the two men in Britain who went on trial for cutting down the famous sycamore gap tree almost 2 years ago. Today, Daniel Graham and Adam Carruthers have been found guilty. A grainy video released during the trial shows the moment the tree was cut down. That video was a key piece of evidence in the case, along with text messages between the defendants. They were texting about how excited they were that stories of the tree's demise were going viral online. They've been convicted of 2 counts of criminal damage per defendant, which carry a maximum prison sentence of 10 years. They'll be sentenced on July 15th. Stay with us. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The U.S. has announced plans to cut $50 million in health aid to Zambia, citing the Zambian government's failure to stop the systemic theft of supplies and medicines. A U.S. investigation of 2,000 pharmacies in Zambia between 2021 and 2023 found that nearly half were selling supplies and medicines that had been paid for with U.S. aid. The U.S. ambassador to Zambia has said the government there has done little to stop this corruption. Charles Kenny is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. He joined us from Washington today.
I think in this case, frankly, it's an excuse and it fits with the general trend in this administration, which is to cut assistance wherever possible. We've estimated that about 126,000 people a year are saved in Zambia by U.S. assistance, or were being saved by U.S. assistance before the administration started cutting aid. Even though it said it was going to preserve life-saving assistance, the evidence of that is limited. I mean, we reckon about 60% of Zambia's assistance has been at least temporarily cut by the US administration, and people are dying as a result. And I think that this is an effort to sort of divert attention from that fact.
So a statement from the U.S. embassy says that in all 10 provinces in Zambia, nearly half of the pharmacies that were selling the kinds of products the United States provides for free to the Zambian people were also selling stolen medications and medical supplies donated by the U.S. government. Stolen medication and medical supplies donated. Again, that's a paraphrase of a U.S. embassy statement. That seems pretty pervasive.
It does sound fairly widespread, and I think everybody, including the new government, agrees that there's a problem that needs to be fixed.
Doesn't that, though, argue there is good cause for this kind of cut for aid?
The problem is that while some, and we don't know what percentage of that aid is being diverted, a lot is getting through, and stopping it, therefore, stops people getting life-saving assistance. And, you know, this administration has said repeatedly, we're going to keep life-saving assistance in place. Here they are, not doing that.
Zambia's health minister, and I think you've alluded to this, has said that Zambia has been working to address the corruption, pointing out that the government has fired, suspended, or even arrested officials who have been involved. Is that the case as far as you know? And if so, why, you know, isn't the U.S. satisfied with that government response?
My suspicion is that this is part of a broader effort and is part of the attempt to basically make the case that aid is wasted, so there's no cost in cutting it.
How reliant is the Zambian health sector on U.S. assistance?
Considerably. As I say, it's providing, was providing at least, a lot of life-saving assistance, particularly in the areas that are being cut right now when it comes to things like malaria and HIV. So it's very sad to see these cuts.
Beyond Zambia, is this a common occurrence?
It's an often used excuse, but one of the things that we know from cases where we properly track what happens to assistance is that actually it doesn't happen terribly often. We have similar kind of efforts in Ukraine going on and similar kind of results. So there is corruption in aid, just like there's corruption across all sorts of government, you know, Medicare and so on. But actually, comparatively, I think, because it's so closely monitored, aid is probably comparatively corruption-free.
Charles Kenny is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. He joined us from Washington. Thousands of undocumented migrants in Portugal are receiving official letters this week warning them to leave voluntarily or face deportation. The government says as many as 18,000 people could be affected. Officials say most of those asked to leave have run afoul of immigration laws. But with a snap election looming this month, critics see politics at work. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
On May 1st, International Workers' Day, hundreds of migrant workers marched through the streets of Lisbon, holding up cardboard signs that read Documentos para Todos, documents for all. 2 days later, the Portuguese government said many of those workers could be going back to their home countries. 4,574 people have already been notified, António Leitão Amaro, Minister for the Presidency, said. They have 20 days to leave voluntarily, appeal, or face deportation. Portugal has deported far fewer undocumented migrants than other European countries, he said. But many migrant workers in Lisbon say getting their hands on the required work visas is almost impossible. I've been working here for more than 4 years, this man told Portuguese television. I don't have a residency card because they won't answer my emails. They don't answer my lawyer, he said. Up until last year, foreigners from outside the EU could enter Portugal on a tourist visa, and after a year of paying social security, could then apply for residency. But the government ended that programme last June. And now campaigners say foreigners are resorting to increasingly desperate measures to try and get the necessary paperwork. Anabella Rodriguez is with the group Migrant Solidarity in Lisbon.
Some people telling us that to arrive in the country, to work in this country, they pay more than 10,000 euros.
It's become a black market operation, she says. On Tuesday, Portuguese police arrested more than a dozen people suspected of being part of a criminal immigration ring. Rodriguez doesn't expect that anywhere near 18,000 people will be deported in the coming weeks, but many foreigners are worried, she says.
You already put fear in the population. You already told them we will be tough on them.
The vast majority work and pay taxes, she says. Portuguese authorities estimate that around 1.6 million foreigners were living in the country last year, making up around 15% of the total population. The largest migrant community is Brazilian. And political scientist Marco Lizzi says these are not the people receiving deportation letters this week.
We are talking about more or less 75% of these notifications are for people from the Indian subcontinent, like Pakistan, Bangladesh and the other countries.
Lizzi teaches politics at Nova University, Lisbon. Portugal heads to the polls next week. And Lizzi says the timing of the announcement by the centre-right government is no accident.
I think the specific time that the government chose to do this is has to do with the campaign and the attempt to gain more votes, especially for the right-wing electorate.
There's a common perception among some in Portugal that immigration is a problem, he says. Cláudio Pereira, director of the Immigration Observatory, says very few lawmakers talk about the upsides of having migrant workers in Portugal.
They work, they contribute to the social security system, and the Portuguese government benefited in 2023 about 2 billion euros from the migrants for the social security system.
And right now, Pereira says, local employers say they desperately need more foreign workers. A mass protest against the threatened deportations is planned for May 16th. 2 days later, Portugal goes to the polls to elect a new government. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Over 6 consecutive days, there have been as many drone attacks on Port Sudan. The paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, has begun using drones to pierce the relative safety the city has long enjoyed despite the civil war raging throughout Sudan. The drones are just one part of the RSF's arsenal. There are other weapons, too, and a new report from Amnesty International says the group is getting them from the United Arab Emirates. Brian Kastner has been investigating the RSF's stockpile of weapons. He explained why any weapons making it into the RSF's hands is a big deal.
There's an arms embargo on Darfur specifically, but not on the whole country. The idea that weapons would go to one part of Sudan and not another really just doesn't make any sense at all. And so the RSF has been committing crimes documented by Amnesty and plenty of other groups as well.
These drone attacks in Port Sudan have struck a place, as I mentioned, that until recently was a respite in a war-torn country. Do we know where the RSF got their hands on these drones?
Drones themselves, we have not investigated exactly which drones are being used in the Port Sudan attack. We don't have specific information. We don't have radar signatures. We don't have a bunch of the other things that you might want to do to say we know specifically which drones were used in Port Sudan. There are a few likely suspects, I would say. So in one video, in a Port Sudan attack, there was fragments of a weapon called the GB-50A, which is a guided bomb. It's a Chinese bomb. And we at Amnesty identified that that weapon was used in March in Darfur in violation of the embargo. And significantly, this bomb had a manufactured date of 2024. So if that evidence holds true, and what appears to be in the video is the case, it appears to be another example of really very advanced and new Chinese weapons being used in Sudan. Those Chinese bombs are dropped by Chinese drones, Wing Loon and others. And we and others have documented that these most likely came from the UAE. China would have sold them to the UAE, and then most likely they were transferred on. It's not just these bombs. We've identified armored vehicles. There's mortars that have been dropped from drones. And those mortars come out of shipping containers that show that they were sold directly to the UAE and they're found in Sudan.
The UAE does strongly deny supplying weapons to Sudan. Can you comment on that?
So I understand that they deny, and we have asked them for a response over the years. We have asked for their input and to respond to us when we've shared this research, and we have yet to receive a reply that is other than the simple denial, as you say. There's a laundry list of weapons, and some of those things are manufactured in the UAE itself.
Does China know that this is where the arms are ending up? Are they also part of this?
So we wrote to Norinco, which is the Chinese arms manufacturer that makes both the H-4 howitzers and the GB-50A guided bombs, and requested information about, are you aware that these weapons have been transferred on? Do you have sales records? They also did not get back to us. China also is a member of the arms trade treaty with the UAE. If they see that the weapons that they're selling are being transferred on and used in a conflict in Sudan, where there's continuing to be war crimes and violations of international law, then it's China's responsibility from now on, going forward, to stop those sales.
Are there examples of when the international community was able to get together and apply enough pressure to choke off arms to a conflict, and it did end up making a big difference?
That's an excellent question. And you know, one of the best examples is immediately south in South Sudan. Now, South Sudan is not a perfect place. The arms embargo has not been a panacea. But over the course of the last 6 or 7 years, having an arms embargo on South Sudan has really choked the flow of weapons there. And I've done weapons investigations in South Sudan. I have found guns that were there that have been transferred illicitly. But it is nothing like the flow of weapons that we see into Sudan. And the scale of human suffering and civilian death in South Sudan has really been reduced. Mm. The point of upholding the arms embargo is ultimately protecting civilians. And so I would say the international community can look next door. And in South Sudan, the embargo is up for a vote in the UN Security Council almost right now in the next couple of weeks. And so just like hopefully the international community continues to live up to their obligations there, they can look just to the north in Sudan and say, you know, this is not going to fix every problem, but it is a step we can take to start.
Brian Kastner is the head of research for Amnesty International. Officials from the U.S. and China are heading to Switzerland this weekend to talk about the trade war. Washington and Beijing both have vowed not to back down, but now the two sides are signaling a willingness to negotiate. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
In a social media post this morning, President Trump suggested that he might be willing to reduce tariffs on China dramatically from 145% to 80%. He called on China's leaders to open up their markets to U.S. goods. And this followed something that Trump said to reporters on Thursday in the Oval Office.
You can't get any higher. It's at 145, so we know it's coming down.
Trump said that the talks in Geneva between U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and China's top economic official, Vice Premier He Lifeng, will be, quote, very, very interesting. In recent weeks, the president had claimed that trade discussions were underway with China, but Beijing denied any negotiations were taking place. Yesterday, Trump would not say which side asked for the meeting in Switzerland.
You know, they very much want to make a deal. We can all play games. Who made the first call? Who didn't make the... It doesn't matter. It only matters what happens in that room. But I will tell you that China very much wants to make a deal. We'll see how that works out.
On Wednesday, China's foreign ministry spokesman Lin Jian acknowledged that the talks in Geneva were happening this weekend, but he said it was the U.S. side that made the request. He said China had not changed its position and is firmly opposed to the U.S. tariffs. Lin added that Beijing will not give in to pressure tactics or coercion. After Trump imposed staggering new tariffs on China in early April, the Chinese government responded with a PR campaign expressing defiance with social media videos like this one.
History has proven compromise won't earn you mercy. Kneeling only invites more bullying. China won't kneel down because we know standing up for ourselves keeps the possibility of cooperation alive.
The talks in Geneva are not expected to produce anything like a final deal between the two largest economies in the world, but they might help lower the temperature in a trade war that's already having an impact across the global economy. Ishwar Prasad is a professor of trade policy and economics at Cornell University.
We seem to be dropping from sky-high tariffs to tariffs that are just skimming the edge of the stratosphere. 80% is still an enormous tariff barrier, but certainly it seems to suggest something of a come down from the even higher tariff rates that Trump had earlier proposed on U.S. imports from China. And it does suggest that he is willing to be somewhat flexible in the negotiations with China, but not too flexible.
If tariffs on imports from China end up staying at 80%, Prasad says American consumers will certainly feel the pain. Chinese negotiators know that, and it will give them leverage at the negotiating table. But China is already feeling the impact of this trade war. Numbers from Beijing today show a rise in Chinese goods sold in Southeast Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. But Ishwar Prasad says that won't make up for what China is losing out on by being effectively shut out of the United States.
China cannot credibly say, okay, to heck with the U.S. market, we're just going to sell our products to other countries. The problem is that practically every other country in the world, including some of China's major export markets in the European Union, in Asia, including Japan and so on, these countries are not doing terribly well. So they don't want a flood of Chinese exports landing up on their doorstep.
Prasad says China's economy was already in trouble before Trump returned to the White House, and that will give the U.S. side leverage in these talks. But beyond economics, the politics are important here, too.
Both sides feel they need to come out with a deal that they can declare a win. Trump, of course, will not settle for anything less than what he would consider a win. But for China, they cannot quite be seen as bending the knee to the U.S.
But this is really just the beginning of what's likely to prove to be a long and complicated process of negotiations ahead. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
It's an uncertain time for international trade and for U.S. colleges and universities. Foreign students typically pay full tuition at U.S. institutions, which has become key to their business models. But many international students say they are now feeling less welcome here. This comes as the pool of domestic students is shrinking due to demographic changes. From GBH in Boston, Kirk Carapeza reports that together these changes could have major consequences for colleges and the economy.
At a high school in Shanghai, Xiaofeng Wan makes his pitch in Mandarin to a packed auditorium of Chinese students and their parents. Wan used to work as an admissions officer at Amherst and Holy Cross. These days, he's a private college consultant, helping Chinese families navigate the path to U.S. colleges. So he's got a front row seat to how they view schools here.
They see the United States as a primary study abroad destination.
But now, he says they worry the U.S. government doesn't want them.
America has an image problem right now. So we will definitely start to see reluctance from families.
I caught up with Wan the same day China warned the 270,000 students in the U.S. to reconsider staying. That message was in response to Trump's tariffs on the country, and it hit home for families who already feel targeted by the White House.
Because that's what they've been hearing from, you know, President Trump, his rhetoric toward Chinese students. And now they're seeing news about how international student visas are being revoked.
During President Trump's first term, visa limits and travel bans contributed to a 12% drop in new international enrollment. This time around, there's widespread fear the situation could be even worse.
I think the government is really hostile right now.
Claire is a parent from Beijing. She asked to withhold her full name, worried it could impact her son, who's already studying here. She also has a daughter in high school who was thinking about colleges in the U.S., but now they're rethinking her plans and looking at schools in the U.K., Canada, Singapore, and Hong Kong.
You know, we have to consider all the possibilities, obviously, in a trade war. Next year, when my child has to go to college, Trump is still the president.
Colleges say they want international students, especially now with fewer American kids heading to college and near constant threats to their federal funding. Since Trump's return to power, his administration has revoked more than 1,000 student visas, often without explanation. Some students have been detained and face deportation, fulfilling a pledge he often made on the campaign trail.
If you come here from another country and try to bring jihadism or anti-Americanism or anti-Semitism to our campuses, we will immediately deport you. You'll be out of that school.
Within his first 100 days, that rhetoric became policy. Nationwide protests followed.
Free Rumisa, free her now!
We want justice, you say how? Free Rumisa, free her now!
Now, many international students are afraid to speak publicly.
The biggest difficulty for us is building trust.
At Harvard, student journalist Frank Joe has seen that fear firsthand. He hosts the weekly news podcast for the student newspaper.
From the Harvard Crimson, I'm Frank Joe. This is News Talk.
Joe isn't an international student himself, but the Chinese-American junior from Dallas is plugged into the campus, where a quarter of students come from other countries.
There are so many international student group chats where students were saying, oh my gosh, there are ICE agents on campus. And so it's quite the Armageddon scenario.
The Trump administration has demanded Harvard turn over detailed records of all foreign students, quote, illegal and violent activities, or lose the right to enroll any international students. Harvard says it has complied, but won't publicly disclose details. The university is suing the administration over this and other demands, but some faculty and students question how hard Harvard is really pushing back. Outside Harvard's Memorial Church, students and faculty wave American flags and hold signs, calling on Harvard to do more to protect their civil rights.
At first, I was very anxious about speaking up.
Leo Jadian is a senior from Sweden. He says the Trump administration is trying to divide the campus community.
They want us to point fingers to each other and say, you know, deport them, don't deport us. And, you know, it's the classic authoritarian playbook.
Conservatives, though, see it very differently. Simon Hankinson at the Heritage Foundation supports tighter visa controls after a year of disruptive, sometimes violent protest.
Sure, go out and hold a placard if you want to and, you know, do your thing, light a candle. But if your primary focus is protest and vandalism, I think you're on the wrong type of visa, and we don't have a visa for that.
And he doubts increased immigration enforcement will scare off students.
Are people not going to go to Harvard because, you know, they're afraid that they're going to get hassled? And no. Try going to Russia or China and speaking your mind. You know, good luck with that.
Higher education institutions do not, at the moment, invite a lot of empathy.
Geraldo Blanco is director of the Center for International Higher Education at Boston College. And he warns Trump's approach, combined with federal funding cuts, is putting U.S. colleges at risk of losing a generation of global talent.
Historically, we've had the ability to attract the greatest talent in any field from around the world, but this is just making it like the Hunger Games, and it's really putting international students in a very precarious situation.
And Blanco says American colleges will need to do a much better job explaining how foreign students and their mobility benefits the U.S. For the World, Kirk Carapeza, Boston.
This story is part of GBH's podcast College Uncovered. The latest episode, The Student Trade Wars, is out now. Listen and subscribe wherever you enjoy audio.
The National Gallery in London is pretty excited about its most recent acquisition. This weekend, the museum will unveil an early Renaissance painting considered a European masterpiece. The gallery paid $20 million for The Virgin and Child with Saints Louis and Margaret.
So this painting is very similar to a lot of things that were happening in the 1500s in what is called the Low Countries, what is Belgium and northern France.
That's an art critic who goes by Seema R on Instagram.
And while we don't know who the artist is, they did a great job. Look at all the details on Saint Louis jewelry.
As you heard, no one knows who the artist is, probably because the panel painted on wood originally served a devotional purpose. It was an altarpiece in a church in modern-day Belgium. The painting shows the Virgin Mary holding Jesus as an infant, with the two surrounded by visitors, hands folded in prayer. They wear sumptuous robes painted in rich reds and blues, but there are also a few details the gallery calls wildly inventive, notably a mystery creature in the foreground, baring its teeth.
Check out this crazy-looking dragon.
A magnificent, slobbering dragon, someone called it. It's almost like it photobombed the rest of the painting.
This artist chose to have a sense of humor. Whoever this is decided to go all out, and that's awesome.
The National Gallery hopes that eventually art historians will be able to identify whoever it is to give credit where credit is due. Sunday is Mother's Day, what a journalist learned by following women in four countries through their first year of motherhood. You're listening to The World. In a photograph taken in Kenya, a new mother perches on the back of a motorcycle holding a baby in a fuzzy peach blanket. In a photograph taken in Finland, another mother and another baby, but this time the baby is strapped into a protective carrier next to the mom in a subway car or maybe a bus. Both images come from a new book called Four Mothers, An Intimate Journey Through the First Year of Parenthood in Four Countries. It comes out just as Americans gear up for Mother's Day. The World's Carol Hills recently caught up with Abigail Leonard, who wrote the book.
Abigail, what inspired you to look at the first year of parenting in this particular way?
So my own first year of parenthood was actually in Japan. I moved to Tokyo when I was 6 months pregnant for my husband's job, and I went on to have two more children there. So I got a pretty good sense of Japanese parenthood. I mean, it's fairly universally difficult that first year, but to go through it in a foreign country and with different ideas about parenthood. And then I came back to the U.S. and understood what American parenthood was like from a different perspective now that I sort of was a parent. So that was the inspiration for the book. And then I just sort of wanted to unpack how much of that first year is difficult because it's just hard. It's hard to make the transition, and how much had to do with where you were in the world.
Tell us briefly first about each of the four women you ended up following, just the snapshot version.
So Tsukasa in Japan is a first-time mom. She's from a small town outside of Tokyo, but where she goes back for the first month with her baby, and her mom helps her. And then she's in Tokyo, and her husband is really busy the entire first year, which is fairly typical for Japanese couples. Chelsea in Nairobi, Kenya is also a first-time mom, had her babies right around the same time as Tsukasa in Japan. And her parents actually passed away before she had her child. So she's dealing with the grief of that in addition to the transition to motherhood. And then in Finland, Anna is the only second-time mother, but it's her first baby with the father of this child. And their relationship actually undergoes a lot of strain because they have different ideas about how to raise children. She was born in Finland and has very egalitarian ideas about mother and father splitting the workload. And he was raised in Asia. And so they just come at it differently. And it causes a good amount of tension that first year. But, you know, she's able to carry on because she has good social programs. And then finally, Sarah in Utah. She's the American mother. She's a teacher. Her husband is an Amazon delivery driver. And she gets 3 months leave, but it's not all paid. And she has to go back to work pretty quickly. And childcare is very expensive and all that stuff.
One of the first things I was struck with was the contrast in how these four women experienced birth itself in terms of the hospital setting, the care, the comfort, and benefits.
Yeah, I found that interesting too. So in Japan, there is not a lot of pain medication that's used in birth. Partly that's because there's sort of a skepticism around opioids, so it's just they're not used generally. But also there's a Buddhist idea apparently that pain bonds the mother and child. I think a lot of Japanese mothers would like access to pain medication, and the woman I profiled she was very nervous going into birth because she had heard how painful it was and she was having these nightmares. And so for her, I think it was a pretty hard experience. Her husband also couldn't be there. It was the tail end of COVID. They were still restricting things. So it was hard for her. She was very happy at the end and very joyful with her baby. But you could just see how it set the tone for motherhood in some ways. And if you contrast that with the woman in Finland who went to a public clinic, like 99% of Finnish women do, she had the option for pain medication, and the whole thing just felt somewhat more relaxed. So you really get a sense of how different it can be.
Well, that prompts me to ask you about the motives behind government parental benefits in each of these countries. You include some really interesting information about that in terms of why Japan offers such great benefits in Finland and these other countries and what's behind that. Because it's not all we love mothers.
No, that's right. In both those cases, Japan and Finland, World War II, they were rebuilding after the war. And so they needed to rebuild the population and they needed to create these systems where people would have more children. So that is similar. But in both places, their populations are decreasing, Japan more precipitously than Finland even. And so there's this strong pronatal movement there to encourage women to have more children. So I sort of benefited from it being there. You feel it. There's all these great services. Midwives come to your house to check on you. You get a baby bonus after your birth. The birth is fully paid for. So there's all these sorts of things. But it is interesting to think about how even with all those benefits, women still aren't having the number of babies that it would take to increase the population, and think about why that is. And my own personal view and experience was that if you don't have the gender equality, if you still have these roles where men have to work all the time and they're not able to be more involved in family, it's a grueling experience for women, no matter how much social support you can offer.
I'm interested to know more about Kenya. I wondered if you found whether the approach to parenting and children there was still rooted more in culture than in things like demographics and birth rates.
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's still a really strong connection to community, although that's breaking down to some extent as more people move to the major cities like Nairobi. But a lot of the traditions still exist. The first haircut, it's the mother and then the father's mother. So the grandmother do that together. So it ties the woman in with her husband's family.
It struck me, too, in reading your book that the role of fathers is really secondary. I mean, you get the feeling that mothers in all four countries are really running the show, either by choice or not. Did that strike you at all?
It did strike me, and it sort of wasn't what I expected going into it, because there were men in their lives. The fathers were around at the beginning, but over time, a few of them faded out for different reasons. And yes, the women really were providing the childcare, like whatever happened. They were the backbone of this experience. And it happens for different reasons. There's cultural reasons, like in Japan, where it's hard for fathers to be involved. And they have now a new policy that encourages men to take paternity leave. And it's actually shown to be really effective. Like once you get the word out and companies want to encourage this, more fathers take it. But you really need these policies in place for the culture to follow, I think, in some ways. Even in the U.S., you felt this, the dad wanted to be more involved, but Amazon drivers don't get paternity leave benefits, even though management level Amazon positions would. And it really affected how the rest of the year went if they didn't get the leave at the beginning. That set the stage for what was going on later.
How did the process of researching and writing this book change you as a parent, or did it at all?
I think it was really nice to see that some of the stuff that frustrated me or the daily level difficulties were universal. Like no matter where you are, no matter what public supports there are, it's always going to be really demanding and difficult. That first year is just really hard. The other thing that I found, and that it started to occur to me when I moved from Japan to the US, is that there are just so many different ways to be a mom and to raise kids and so many different cultures around it, that if you sort of remember that, it can be freeing. The expectations of American parenthood can be very intense, and they're only amplified on social media, but there are just a million ways to do this. So I found that to be really helpful to remember.
Abigail Leonard's new book is called Four Mothers, An Intimate Journey Through the First Year of Parenthood in Four Countries. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. Macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillianne Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.